K-Mud Podcast presents. Good morning and welcome to Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes. Well, I opened with Northern Cree, they gave us good times because we have to think of the good times while all the bad times are going around and try to keep it all in balance. I'm going to begin by sharing just an incredible essay by Julie Francella. And it's kind of long, but it was just so on point. And I just think it's something that we all need to hear. And she says, Hofstede, Indian country, and the machinery we recognize, what Native people know about surviving a country coming undone. And she says, I was scrolling because apparently that's where we all go now to check whether the world is still on fire or someone has posted that this administration is, quote, destroying the country. Not testing our intuition, our institutions, which always sounds to me like something said by people who still want to believe the walls are fine, even though the kitchen is full of smoke. And I just sat there for a minute, thumb hovering over the screen because, yes, that is true, but also Native people recognize the room. Not in a smug way, not in a we told you so way, though to be fair, Native people and Black people have been telling this country a few things for quite some time, and America keeps acting like it missed the memo. I mean it more like this. Pull up a chair. The room you just walked into has been occupied for generations. Native people know what it feels like. So when people say, quote, they are destroying democracy, I believe them, I do. But I also want to say, honestly, democracy was never evenly distributed here. Maybe that's where the misunderstanding begins. A lot of people are calling this moment in time apocalyptic because they are watching institutions shake, rights disappear, laws bend. And powerful people decide things for the rest of us. And yes, that is terrifying. But call it apocalyptic is also a very Western way of seeing the world because it assumes the end is something still coming. And Native people know better. We have already lived through an apocalypse. We are still living through one. It came with ships, crosses, soldiers, schools, policies, maps, courts, pipelines, and clean little government words that made destruction sound inevitable and orderly. So when people say this feels like the end of the world, I understand the fear, but I also want to say, whose world? Because for Native people, the world ended around 1492, and then we had to wake up the next morning and feed the kids. We had to bury our dead, hide our ceremonies, save our languages, protect our water, and keep going anyway. Some people are just now feeling the stormy weather Native and Black people have been standing in for generations. This is not the apocalypse arriving. This is the machinery of apocalypse becoming visible to people who were once protected from its worst edges. And because my brain is a strange little campfire where politics, teaching, history, and jokes all swirl around together like smoke, this made me think about Hofstede. I know, nothing says, come sit by the fire like a Dutch social psychologist, but keep listening so you see what I mean. Hofstede's six dimensions of national culture are usually dragged into business and communication classes to talk about how societies handle power, among other things. The six dimensions are commonly listed as power, distance, individualism / collectivism, masculinity / femininity, uncertainty, avoidance, short-term / long-term orientation, and indulgence / restraint. I'm attempting to use Hofstede to explain America, or more specifically, I'm using him to hold up a mirror, because sometimes a tool from the classroom becomes useful when you turn it around and point it back at the house that built the classroom. And what it shows, at least for me, is that America is not just having a political crisis, it's having a cultural one. The values it bragged about were often not values at all. They were habits of empire, and now those habits are eating the house. 1, individualism without responsibility becomes abandonment. America loves the individual, the self-made man, the lone cowboy, the rugged entrepreneur, the guy in the truck commercial standing on land he probably doesn't have permission to be on. Everything is personal freedom, personal responsibility, personal success, and even personal brand. Don't get me wrong, I like personal freedom. Who doesn't? But individualism without responsibility becomes abandonment. It becomes your child, your problem, your water, your problem, your sacred site, your problem, your deportation, your problem, your lost job, your problem, your health care, your problem, your rights. Well, we'll see what the courts say, assuming anyone listens. That's what I hear in the birthright citizenship fight. The Supreme Court is weighing several major Trump-related cases right now, including his attempt to restrict birthright citizenship and his administration's move to end temporary protected status for more than 356,000 Haitian and Syrian immigrants. The birthright citizenship case comes from an exclusive order that would deny citizenship to children born in the United States if their parents are not citizens or green card holders. Basically, the government is arguing over which babies count. Native people know something about governments deciding which children belong. Black Americans know it. Immigrants know it. Poor people know it. Queer and trans people know it. Disabled people know it. Anyone who has ever had to prove their humanity knows it. Many indigenous cultures begin somewhere else. Many of our teachings remind us that a person is not just a person isolated on their own. You are your people. You are your family, your ancestors, your obligations, your land, your water, your dead, your future generations. You are your community. America keeps calling this dependency because America has confused individualism with strength, but Native collectivism has always known something this country is now being forced to learn the hard way. Survival is not an individual achievement. It is a collective relationship held together by obligation, responsibility to your fellow humans and nature, and the simple truth that when one person is hurting, the whole circle feels it. 2, power distance, when the people furthest from the harm make the decisions. Holstead called one of his dimensions power distance, which is basically how comfortable a society is with hierarchy, and colonialism loves hierarchy. It loves forms, permits, hearings, panels, consultation sessions, folding chairs, and hierarchical titles. Indian country knows power distance. We know what it means when the people farthest from the harm get the most authority. And now other people are starting to see what power does when it is put into the hands of empire. It reaches. It goes after courts, lawyers, voters, immigrants, universities, teachers, journalists, anyone who says, actually, there are rules here, and anyone who dares to stand beside the people empire has already decided are disposable. An Associated Press review found that since February of 2025, district court judges ruled the Trump administration was violating court orders in at least 31 lawsuits, including cases involving funding cuts, mass layoffs, deportations, and immigration practices. This is not ordinary politics. This is the powerful testing the power testing the walls. And if the walls fold, they push harder. Then there are the law firms. A federal appeals court heard arguments this month over Trump's executive orders targeting major firms, including Perkins Coie, Jenner and Brock, Wilmer Hale, and Sussman Goffrey. The orders sought to punish firms that had represented or employed people Trump viewed as political enemies, and 4 separate district court judges had already determined those executive orders were unconstitutional. That should scare people, and not just people who went to law school and like to say, quote, pursuant to in casual conversation. When a government starts punishing lawyers for standing beside the wrong people, it is not only talking to lawyers, it is talking to everyone. It is saying, be careful who you defend, be careful who you represent, be careful who you stand beside when those in power are vengeful. 3, Competition without care becomes cruelty. Another Hofstadt dimension is often called masculinity versus femininity. What he means is whether society values dominance, competition, achievement, toughness, and winning, or whether it values care, cooperation, quality of life, and support for the vulnerable. Look around. America loves winning. Bigger bombs, bigger trucks, bigger walls, bigger prisons, bigger pipelines, bigger flags, bigger speeches about freedom from people who are absolutely terrified of school libraries. Some people in this country have spent a long time confusing cruelty with strength. Cut the program, that's strength. Mock the vulnerable, that's strength. Ignore the sick, that's strength. Punish the protester, that's strength. Drill faster, deport harder, cut deeper, apologize never. The White House's own fiscal year 2026 budget release said the proposal will cut non-defense discretionary spending by $136 billion, or 23%, while increasing defense spending by 13%, and Homeland Security appropriations by nearly 65%. It says care is waste. It says science is optional. It says education is suspicious. It says health can be trimmed. It throws money at the border, which means the border gets fed before the hungry child does. An Indian country knows what happens when governments put survival on the chopping block. The National Indian Child Welfare Association warned that the FY 2026 budget request proposed significant cuts to federal human service programs that tribes access, including programs connected to HHS and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The National Indian Health Board also reported that the FY 2026 HHS proposal included eliminations or reductions to several tribal-serving health programs, including mental and behavioral health funding streams and programs serving American Indian and Alaska Native communities. And this is where Hofstadt's language gets a little clunky, because calling one side masculine and the other feminine already tells you something about the worldview that built the framework. In many indigenous communities, strength was not supposed to mean domination. It was not supposed to mean winning at all costs, taking more than you need, or confusing loudness with leadership. Many Native nations held and still hold a much more relational understanding of power. Women, aunties, grandmothers, clan mothers, mothers, two-spirit people, and caretakers have carried political, spiritual, cultural, and economic authority in ways colonial systems often refuse to understand or actively try to destroy. Care was not treated as some soft little thing beside the, quote, real work of leadership. Care was the work. Feeding people was governance. Raising children was nation building. Protecting water was law. Holding ceremony was survival. Remembering kinship was infrastructure. Colonialism brought a harder patriarchal order with it, one that tried to shrink indigenous women's power, shame gender diversity, and replace relational leadership with hierarchy, ownership, extraction, and control. So when America confuses cruelty with strength, indigenous people recognize that too. We have seen what happens when a culture decides domination is masculine, care is weak, and the land is something to conquer. But in many indigenous ways of knowing, the so-called feminine is not weakness. It is continuity. It is the force that keeps the people alive. It is the aunties organizing food, the grandmothers carrying language, the water protectors standing between the river and the machine, the people who know that survival is not just about fighting enemies, but about keeping the circle intact. And when a government starts treating care like waste, people begin to live in a state of fear. They wake up wondering what will be cut next, who will be targeted next, and whether anyone in power can still be told no. which brings us to uncertainty. 4. Uncertainty avoidance, fear as a weather system. Some people are just now learning what it feels like to wake up and wonder what rule changed overnight. Will my vote count? Will my kid be recognized as a citizen? Will my lawyer be punished? Will my school lose funding? Will my neighbor be taken? Will the court order matter? Will anyone in power be told no and actually stop? That feeling has a name, uncertainty. And in Holstaff's framework, uncertainty avoidance is about how cultures deal with not knowing. Colonial systems hate uncertainty when it belongs to them, but they love creating it for other people. Native people have lived with uncertainty as a daily weather system. Will the funding come through? Will the clinic stay open? Will the school have what it needs? Will the court remember the treaty? Will the sacred place still be there next year? Will the government honor its own agreement this time, or will everybody have to become a lawyer again by Monday? And living like that does something to a people. It teaches you to plan beyond the next headline. Native communities have had to think past election cycles, past funding cycles, past court decisions, past whatever crisis the government created this week, because survival has always required a longer memory than the state wants us to have, which is why the next dimension matters so much. 5. Long-term orientation. This country keeps eating tomorrow. Then there is the long-term versus the short-term thinking, and this is where America needs to sit down and stop touching things. This country loves to say, quote, future generations, while behaving like we have unlimited resources. It wants what it wants now. Oil now, profit now, power now, votes now, headlines now, tax cuts now, a culture war now, a scapegoat now, a shiny distraction now, and the future can tend for itself, Native people know this pattern because we have always lived inside it. The land was the first budget cut. The first efficiency measure was removal. The first school reform was assimilation. The first energy policy was extraction from somebody else's sacred place. Many indigenous teachings ask a different question. What does this decision do 7 generations from now? What will it do by Friday or by the next election or by the next earnings call? But what will it do to the water, the children, the language, the bones in the ground, the food systems, the stories, the people who will inherit whatever mess we are too selfish to clean up? 7 generations is an indigenous worldview and philosophy. People love to call Native people traditional, as if that means stuck in the past. But a lot of our so-called traditional knowledge is actually future technology. It is what survival looks like when you stop pretending the land is a dead thing. And every once in a while, someone outside Native circles says the thing clearly enough that people actually hear it. Maybe because it comes from someone familiar. Maybe because America sometimes needs Han Solo to explain what aunties have been saying forever. Maybe our ancestors heard our prayers because Harrison Ford showed up at Arizona State University and said the same thing America needs to hear. Yes, that Harrison Ford, Han Solo, Indiana Jones. The man has spent a good portion of his life on screen running from boulders, Nazis, stormtroopers, snakes, and on one occasion, aliens. Anyway, at ASU's undergraduate commencement on May 11th of 2026, Ford received an honorary doctorate of arts in human letters, and he told graduates, quote, "We need cultural change. We need to extend social justice. We need to respect and elevate indigenous people that are being marginalized." He also told them to, quote, "stand up for someone who can't stand up for themselves," and call that leadership. And I know some people will hear that and think, okay, celebrity says good thing at graduation. Everybody claps, someone's auntie posts the clip on Facebook, and the machine keeps chewing. Fair. But I think it matters, not because Harrison Ford is suddenly the spokesperson for Indigenous survival, but it matters because he said the simple thing out loud and actually said it out loud that Indigenous people have been screaming about for decades. You cannot talk about climate without talking about land. You cannot talk about conservation without talking about the people who have been protecting land while governments and corporations treated it like it's disposable. You cannot talk about the future while silencing the people whose teachings were built around making sure there would be one. And maybe that is the heart of the whole thing. Leadership is not domination. Leadership is not winning the loudest. Leadership is not cutting the most vulnerable people loose and calling it strength. Leadership is standing beside the people the machinery was designed to grind down and then having the humility to listen when they tell you how the machine works. But listening requires restraint. It requires giving up the fantasy that freedom means getting whatever you want, whenever you want it, no matter who pays the price. And that may be one of America's hardest lessons. 6. Indulgent without restraint becomes greed dressed up as freedom. The last Holstead dimension is indulgence versus restraint. And in America, indulgent it, but not in the fun way. It indulges billionaires and restrains poor people. It indulges corporations and restrains climate activists. It indulges historical fantasy and myth and restrains teachers who teach the truth. It indulges extraction and restrains land defenders. It indulges people who want to rewrite the past and restrains the people who survived it. Native restraint is different. Ours is take what you need, don't waste, don't insult the animals, don't poison the water, don't treat the land like a disposable thing, don't confuse appetite with freedom. The last one could save the world if everyone put it on a bumper sticker. And I just want to interject here because I was reading that. I'm 77, and this is when I was in high school, 17 senior, and I forgot, civics class or something, and the teacher started talking about the meaning of freedom. And, he had this whole big list, and I was like the second person or third person to raise my hand. And I said, well, you really can't talk about freedom unless you talk about responsibility, because when you take care of responsibilities, then you're free. And he looked at me, stared me down. He said, that's the bottom of the list. And he had all these things he wanted to say, and he was going to end his whole lesson about responsibility. Only, at 17, I figured it out and said it right away, and I kind of blew his class lesson for the day. But anyway, Mr. Derigi, it wasn't Mr. Derigi, it was this other guy. Because what America often calls freedom is just appetite that's waving an American flag. The freedom to take, burn, own, ignore, and never be inconvenienced by anyone else's suffering. But real freedom requires responsibility. Yes, I figured that out as a teenager. Otherwise, it's just destruction of those who don't fit into the elite class. What we do with the smoke. This is why Holstead actually helps here. His framework names the culture sickness under the politics. Individualism without responsibility becomes abandonment. Power distance without humility becomes authoritarianism. Competition without care becomes cruelty. Uncertainty used as a weapon becomes fear. Short-term thinking eats tomorrow. Indulgence without restraint becomes greed. That's the machinery. That's what people are seeing now. And once you see it, you have a choice. You can pretend it's new, which is comforting but useless, or you can admit that the machine has been running for a long time and was simply pointed at Native people, Black people, immigrants, poor people, disabled people, queer and trans people, women, children, prisoners, and the land first. That doesn't mean nothing can be done. It means the people who have survived the machine might know something about how to live in these times without losing their minds. This is where the listening has come in. Listen to Native people. Listen to Black people. Listen to immigrants. Listen to the land. I mean, listen like your survival depends on it, because honestly, it might. And then do something with what you heard. Feed somebody. Protect somebody. Put your body in the movement, as Simon says on our We're Still Here segment. Tell the truth somewhere. They were hoping for silence. That is what Native people have been doing after the end of the world in 1492. Not just surviving, but carrying instructions. So no, everything is not okay. Let's not insult each other. But the fire is not only destruction. Sometimes it's a warning. Stay close to the people who know how to live after the world has already ended once. They might teach you how to carry water, gather people, and keep yourself human while the smoke is still in the air. Julie Francella.
Yeah.
And that was Thomas Momfumo from the Shona tribe of Zimbabwe, Everything Big in America. Well, I'm going to share this with you, and it's about Sitting Bull, and just, you know, want to shatter some of that myth, you know, that because he joined the Wild West show. But when Sitting Bull agreed to join Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show on May 17th of 1885, the announcement rippled through newspapers across the United States. Reporters struggled to reconcile the image they had created of him, the, quote, arch enemy of the United States, the man whose vision preceded the defeat of Custer, with the reality of a Lakota leader stepping into a traveling entertainment spectacle. But according to historian Robert M. Utley in The Lance and the Shield, Sitting Bull entered the show with his dignity intact and his purpose firmly his own. He was not there to play a role. He was there to observe a world that had overrun the plains and understand the people who are now surrounding his nation. Utley explained that Sitting Bull's contract with Cody lasted only a few months, but those months were dense with meaning. Cody paid him $50 a week, a significant wage in 1885, and treated him as a special attraction rather than a regular performer. Cody understood that Sitting Bull's presence alone could fill arenas. But Sitting Bull did not join the show to entertain white audiences. He joined to see them. He told one bull that he wanted to study the people whose government had broken its promises to the Lakota, to understand their ways, their beliefs, and the contradictions that shaped their society. This motivation is consistent with Lakota oral history and one with one bull's known role as Sitting Bull's closest companion. What Sitting Bull actually did in the show was far more modest than the public imagined. He refused to reenact battles, refused to attack stage settlers, and refused to participate in mock fights. His, quote, performance, as described by Utley and confirmed by period newspapers, consisted of a single dignified ride around the arena. He would enter on horseback, circle the crowd once, and then sit before them, silent and composed. That was all. He would not paint his face, would not pretend to be defeated, and would not allow himself to be turned into a caricature. The St. Paul Pioneer Press described him as, quote, self-possessed and observant, noting that he seemed more interested in the crowd than in the spectacle around him. In a show built on myth, Sitting Bull insisted on being real. Sometimes he addressed the audience. His remarks were brief but pointed. Utley notes that he spoke about broken treaties, starvation on the reservations, and the conditions of Lakota children. These speeches were not part of Cody's script. They were Sitting Bull's own interventions, moments of truth inserted into a fantasy designed to reassure white America of its innocence. Some newspapers complained that his remarks were, quote, political, but others noted that the crowds listened with fascination. In the middle of a spectacle meant to erase Native people, Sitting Bull stood there and told America the truth about itself. He also discovered that white audiences would pay for his autograph, 50 cents apiece, a considerable sum. Utley records that he signed thousands of cards, sometimes adding sharp, humorous comments that revealed his dry wit and his critique of white society. One of his best documented lines he wrote was, "I am Indian. I am not a fool." Several show employees remembered this line, and it appears in multiple accounts of his time with the show. It was a small but unmistakable assertion of sovereignty. Again, "I am Indian. I am not a fool." Sitting Bull's observation about white society was not limited to the arena. Charles Eastman, Oyesa, recorded one of Sitting Bull's most famous reflections in Indian Heroes and Great Chieftains, quote, "The white man knows how to make everything, but he does not know how to distribute it." Eastman also preserved another of Sitting Bull's insights. Again, that's what Sitting Bull said. "The white man knows how to make everything, but he does not know how to distribute it." He also said, "The love of possessions is a disease with them." These statements align with what Sitting Bull witnessed on the road, towns where some people lived in abundance while others, especially children, lived in poverty. He often spoke about the conditions of white children, noting their hunger and their ragged clothing, and he contrasted this with the Lakota belief that no child should go without. His comments were not made in bitterness, but in observation. He was studying a society that valued accumulation over generosity, and he found it bewildering. His response was to give. Udly and Stanley Vestal both described Sitting Bull's extraordinary generosity during the tour. He gave away most of his earnings to poor children and families in the towns the show visited. He bought food for the hungry and handed coins to children who followed him through the streets. Cody himself reportedly joked that Sitting Bull, quote, gave away more than he kept. To Sitting Bull, this was not charity. It was Lakota values in action. A leader provides, a leader shares, a leader ensures that children are fed. And then there was the moment that only Lakota witnesses understood, the moment preserved by Vestal in Sitting Bull. Champion of the Sioux, drawn from his interviews with One Bull and White Bull, sometimes when the crowd roared for him to speak, Sitting Bull would step forward and address them in Lakota. The audience, of course, understood nothing. They only heard the cadence of his voice and saw the dramatic sweep of his hand. They assumed he was praising them, thanking them, or offering some noble sentiment. But according to One Bull's account, Sitting Bull would look out at the thousands of cheering white spectators and say in Lakota, "I hate all white people. You are thieves and liars." And the crowd would erupt in applause. They cheered because they believed he was honoring them. They cheered because they could not imagine he would speak plainly. They cheered because they did not understand him, not his language, not his humor, not his grief, not his judgment. Vestal writes that Sitting Bull found this darkly amusing. Afterwards, he would turn to One Bull and remark on how easily the whites were fooled by their assumptions. They expected him to be grateful. They expected him to be impressed. They expected him to be humbled by their world. Instead, he told them the truth, and they applauded. Sitting Bull watched the audiences closely. Utley describes them as, quote, studying the white man while trying to understand the people who had overrun the plains. He saw their hunger for stories that made them feel innocent. He saw their fascination with the very people their government was trying to erase. He saw their confusion when he refused to play the role they expected. He shared these observations with One Bull, who carried them forward. In this way, Sitting Bull's time with the Wild West Show became not a performance, but a form of reconnaissance, a study of the colonial mind. His months with the show reveal a man who entered a colonial spectacle without surrendering his dignity. He used the platform to speak truth. He observed white society with sharp intelligence. He practiced generosity everywhere he went, and he remained fully Lakota in a world that tried to define him. His time with the show was not a humiliation. It was a strategic witnessing. He walked into America's myth and refused to disappear inside it. And this is an honoring song for Sitting Bull. Hey! And that was a honoring song for Sitting Bull. And it comes from a great CD. It's 35 years old. It's called Oyate. And it honors Crazy Horse, Manuelito, Santana, Quanah Parker, Chief Joseph, Captain Jack, Black Kettle, Red Cloud, Geronimo, Lone Wolf, Cohiz, and Sitting Bull. And it used all different artists. And John Trudell is one of them. He was part of this project. And he was visiting me one time when I was living out in Whitethorn. And he saw it and he goes, "Man, here it is. I never even got a copy of this." And so I said, "You take it. I'll find another." He goes, "You sure?" I said, "I know I will." And the next time I was in Southern California and went into Amoeba Records in Hollywood, there was a copy just waiting for me, a used copy. So I was so happy that I gave it to him. I'm going to close with the Porcupine Singers, and it's a song, a happy birthday song, and it's a song of encouragement sung for who's having a birthday, and Cayman is having a birthday, and we could always use encouragement, encourage you to come on down and help us out. And I did want to just real quickly give you an interpretation of that honoring song for Sitting Bull, because what they were singing was, "My people have courage. Stand together now that my life has ended. Have courage." And Chief Sitting Bull said this and left his people. And that's what they were singing. So here's a birthday song. Happy birthday, Cayman.
Ah! has been a K-Mite podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.